Welcome to this 11kbw podcast, a judicial review update by Andrew Sharland, QC. This talk was given at the 11kbw Local Authority Conference on the 27th of September 2018 at the Turing Lecture Theatre in London. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Thank you very much, everyone. Good morning. Another year, another judicial review update. Unfortunately, there haven't been any big bang moments in judicial review recently. The Administrative Court, and to an extent the Court of Appeal, keep on churning out cases. The law develops by a slow process of accretion, but no seismic shifts, which is rather annoying if you're trying to give a judicial review talk. So what I've done today is pick six broad topics and try to extract some practical points which are relevant in the local government context. Not all the cases I'm talking about are local government cases, but I hope the principles are relevant. Firstly, duty to give reasons. Secondly, challenges based on systemic unfairness. Thirdly, that old chestnut you all love, the public sector equality duty. Fourthly, bias. Fifthly, irrationality, and finally, a couple of procedural cases to conclude. So, duty to give reasons. As I'm sure you're all aware, there's no general duty to give reasons at common law. That's what the House of Lords in Doody found 20 or so years ago. However, in certain circumstances, fairness requires that reasons are to be given. Factors that are taken into account when deciding whether fairness requires reasons include the type of the decision maker, the significance of the decision for the individual in question, the subject matter of the decision, and the need for reasons to facilitate a challenge. Now, justifications for not imposing a duty in a particular case are the requirement to give reasons places undue burdens on the decision maker, and also giving reasons may expose issues of national security and confidential information. The latter two are unlikely to be that relevant in the local government context, but imposing a duty on the decision maker is something that's thought to be important. I have to say, I'm not massively convinced by this. The decision maker, in any event, has to grapple with the issues and make a reasoned judgment. All the duty to give reasons imposes is to set out in summary what those reasons were. Now, two recent cases on duty to give reasons, they both arise in the planning context, and therefore I'm going to briefly outline the position on duty to give reasons in this area before discussing the two cases. In relation to refusals of planning permission, there is a duty to give brief reasons to enable the disappointed party to appeal if they so wish. In relation to local authority decisions to grant planning permission, there's no general duty to give reasons. That's what the Court of Appeal determined in a case called Chaplin in 1998. Now, there was statutory intervention in 2003, which imposed a summary duty to give reasons for a decision to grant planning permission. That statutory duty was repealed in 2013, by the Cameron government on the basis that it imposed too great a duty on local authorities. On revocation of the statutory duty, it was thought the position would return to Chaplin, no general duty, other than in cases where an environmental impact assessment is required, where there is a statutory duty. First case I'm going to deal with is the case of Oakley and South Cambridgeshire District Council. This case, the council granted planning permission for a football stadium in Greenbelt land with no reasons in face of the officer's recommendation to refuse. This was inappropriate development in Greenbelt land and a departure from the local plan. Court of Appeal in this case held that there was a breach of the duty to give reasons. Lord Justice Sales, as he then was, said, fairness requires reasons in this case. Whereas here there's a departure from the development plan, the need for reasons is especially pressing. It will help focus the decision maker's consideration of such a sensitive issue. Now, Lord Justice Elias agreed with Lord Justice Sales, but he suggested a more radical approach. He mused that perhaps the common law had moved towards a general duty to give reasons unless there is proper justification for not doing so, as where the reasons are, So this is a topic that's been talked about for years in academic circles, whether there should be a general duty. It was thought that the issue was going to arise squarely in the Supreme Court in the Dover case. In this case, the council approved 500 or so houses in an area of outstanding national beauty, again against the advice of the planning officers. No reasons were given. Now, although this wasn't spotted at an earlier stage, by the time it got to the Supreme Court, it was accepted that an environmental impact assessment was required in this case, and therefore there was a statutory duty to give reasons. Reasons hadn't been given, therefore there was a clear breach. But the Supreme Court went on to give obiter to comments about whether there should be a general common law duty to give reasons when granting planning permission where there is no EIA required. And the Supreme Court concluded there was no such general duty. They didn't take up Lord Justice Elias's suggestion, albeit they concluded that Oakley had been correctly decided. So in light of these two cases, what should you do in planning cases where planning permission is granted? If the officer's report recommends a grant of planning permission and that is accepted by the council, the reasons for the council will be taken to be those of the officer's report, so there's no need to give additional reasons. The duty only arises where the councillors reject the advice of the officer, and my view is, out of an abundance of caution in all such cases, you should ask the decision maker to give reasons, because there is a risk that if you don't, you will be subject to a successful duty to give reasons challenge. Outside the planning context, I think these judgments are relevant an important indication of the court's willingness to impose a duty to give reasons, albeit there's no general recognition that there is a duty in all such cases. It's good practice for decision makers to formulate reasons. It should improve the quality of their decision making, but obviously the downside is if you do formulate reasons, you potentially open yourself up to challenge if those reasons are not very good. Second topic I'm going to deal with, completely different, systemic challenges. This is a trendy new ground of judicial review. It's a broad challenge to a process on the basis that that process is inherently unfair. There have been a number of successful challenges advancing this ground of judicial review in recent years, particularly in the context of fast-tracked immigration. Beginning of this year, there was a judgment of where this ground was explored, case of Woolcock against Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government. This case concerned the challenge to the system whereby council tax defaulters were committed to prison. Magistrates were, with that alarming degree of regularity, failing to follow the correct procedure and imprisoning persons who hadn't paid their council tax, particularly in South Wales and Kent for some reason. Don't know what was particularly problematic with magistrates in those areas, but that was what the evidence was. Now, Ms. Woolcock had successfully challenged the decision to imprison her on narrow grounds relating to the individual decision, but she articulated a broader challenge to the whole scheme of imprisonment for council tax default. Permission was granted. She said the whole scheme was inherently unfair. There were a number of defendants, Ministry of Justice, who were responsible for magistrates, the DCLG and the Welsh Government, who were responsible for council tax. And the Divisional Court, Lord Justice Hickenbottom and Mr. Justice Lewis, gave useful guidance, relatively useful guidance, on the approach to be adopted. The claim failed. The court said, challenge, of course, concerns the fairness of procedure used by a public body. Where procedure is fair, that's a matter for the court. An administrative scheme will be open to a systemic challenge if there is something inherent in the scheme that gives rise to an unacceptable risk of procedural fairness. They went on to say that there's a conceptual difference between something inherent in a system that gives rise to an unacceptable risk of procedural fairness and even a very large number of decisions that are simply individually aberrant. So that was a distinction they drew. They then went on to blur that distinction by saying, however, this does not mean that consideration of individual cases is necessarily irrelevant. Where there is evidence of lots of problems, this may provide strong evidence to draw an inference that there is a systemic problem. So I don't think this guidance is particularly clear, particularly helpful. The Divisional Court concluded in this particular case, although there were lots of instances of magistrates getting it wrong, getting it profoundly wrong, that was not sufficient evidence of an inherent something inherent in the system. But actually explaining why that was the case and extrapolating to future cases, I don't think is that easy. Another important point about this case is the claimant never really identified the actual decision being challenged. As I said, there were lots of defendants, and every defendant said, well, it's not our decision challenge, we're not doing anything wrong here. And the court broadly concluded that the claimant had failed to identify a particular decision, and of course, judicial review claims, you have to identify the decision challenged. So in this area, that's something to look out. Has the claimant clearly articulated what they're actually challenging? Public sector equality duty. Most of you are no doubt very familiar with the requirements of the public sector equality duty under section 149 of the Equality Act. Paragraph 26 of the Court of Appeals judgment in Bracking summarises the general principles in this area. I'm sure you will have read it time and time again. That summary was approved by the Supreme Court in Hottack. Now, whilst there's little debate in the case law about the applicable principles, there's still a significant number of cases reaching the Court of Appeal because there is dispute as to how those principles are applied to a particular case. High Court judges regularly get it wrong. It is difficult. And I've got one such example of a case that did reach the Court of Appeal, albeit they concluded the High Court were right in this context. Jewish Human Rights Watch against Leicester City Council, Swansea City Council and Gwynedd Council. This challenge concerned a non-binding resolution passed by councillors in the respective local authorities purporting to boycott goods from the occupied Palestinian territories. The claimant, a recently formed company said to be representing Jewish views in this area, asserted that the council had failed to comply with the public sector equality duty, that they hadn't done what they were required to do. Now, the Divisional Court concluded that either the public sector equality duty did not apply to council resolutions, or it did not apply with its normal rigour. The judgment on this point is somewhat opaque, put it politely. Divisional Court held that applying the public sector equality duty in this context, or applying it with full rigour, would adversely impact on the ability of councillors to exercise their rights of political speech. The Court of Appeal, however, took a more orthodox approach. They concluded that the council were required to comply with the public sector duty when passing resolutions. That was one of its functions of which Section 149 applied. However, they went on to conclude that the council had discharged its duty in this case, having regard to the terms of the resolution and the nature of the debate. The terms of the resolution included reference to the values of tolerance, diversity, unity, and non-discrimination. The monitoring officer in Leicester saw this resolution shortly before it was being debated and amended it, or suggested an amendment, which improved it and which I think was critical in the end. The Court of Appeal concluded that the text of the resolution and the debate somehow discharged the public sector equality duty. I think this is quite a generous reading of the debate in this case. I read the debate on a number of occasions and I struggled to extract rigorous consideration of the public sector equality duty from it. There's no mention of the public sector equality duty. There's no mention in any of the papers leading to the resolution of the public sector equality duty. But the Court of Appeal were prepared to conclude that sufficient regard was had in this particular case. And I think the point you can draw from this is the application of Section 149 is very context specific. It's important not to treat the Bracking guidance as statute. The principles in Bracking were expressed in the context of a challenge to a decision that had a big impact on a large number of people with a protected characteristic. And the precise approach set out there will not necessarily be adopted in every such case. Moving swiftly on, bias. Three main types of bias. Actual bias. This is very rare. It's hard to prove, and there is little advantage in a claimant pleading it. The only reason to plead actual bias is if there has been express waiver, and actual bias may overcome express waiver where apparent bias doesn't. But apparent bias is by far the most common form of bias. And the question there is where a fair-minded and informed observer, having considered the facts, will conclude that there was a real possibility that the decision maker was biased. Third category, slightly rarer, presumed bias, also known as automatic disqualification. This is where a decision maker has a direct financial interest in the outcome of the case. That was extended by the House of Lords in Pinochet to include whether the decision maker was promoting a cause. In that case, Lord Hoffman promoting Amnesty International. Now, related but distinct from bias is the concept of predetermination. A decision maker must not predetermine a matter that falls for his or her decision, i.e. they must not make up their mind in advance and refuse to consider a matter on its merits. You can't have a closed mind. The relevant test when you're looking at predetermination is the appearance of predetermination, whether a fair-minded and informed observer, having considered the facts, would conclude that there was a real possibility that the decision-maker predetermined the issue. Now, the courts adopt a strict approach on predetermination for judicial decision-makers, but a far more relaxed approach where the relevant decision-maker is a democratically elected councillor or minister. Earlier this year, Court of Appeal considered the issue of predetermination in the context of Ombudsman. Decision of the Health Service Ombudsman. The Ombudsman had upheld a complaint made by a wife of an individual who had died in hospital. The Ombudsman concluded that the medical treatment was inadequate and the death would have been avoided if he had received appropriate care. So a very damning conclusion. Mr. Justice Lewis rejected the challenge on all grounds. Court of Appeal reversed him on the predetermination ground. Court said predetermination arises where a judge or other decision maker makes a final conclusion before he or she is in possession of all the relevant evidence and arguments. And now, what the court did in this case was look at the whole of the Ombudsman's file in chronological order and picked out comments by the Ombudsman or the individual considering it, which they concluded indicated that they'd made a decision before they had got all the evidence. It's quite an interesting case because it shows the willingness of the Court of Appeal to scrutinise decisions in a very exacting way to consider this issue of predetermination. So if you are a decision maker, bear this in mind, make sure the record of the decision, if it's an ongoing decision, does not suggest any form of predetermination, any form of final decision before everything has come in. Second point I think is useful from the local government context is I'm regularly asked by councils to advise on challenging the local government ombudsman. There's increasing unhappiness with ombudsman decisions. And generally, in the past, the courts have adopted a very deferential approach to the ombudsman. They haven't really wanted to scrutinise their decision-making that carefully. Miller is an example of the Court of Appeal carrying out a very exacting scrutiny. And from that side, I think it's quite a helpful decision for local governments, local councils who may wish to challenge ombudsman's decisions in the future. Penultimate topic, irrationality. Again, something you're all familiar with, studied it at university or college. Over the years, the courts have expanded this principle. It's been held in some cases that a disproportionate decision is an irrational decision, an unreasonable decision. And in other cases, the courts have suggested that a decision which treats similarly situated parties differently is also irrational. This is the concept of equal treatment that was considered in some detail by the Supreme Court in the Gallagher case. I'm going to have to take you through the facts of this case in a little bit of detail so you understand the decision that was reached by the Supreme Court. This case concerned a challenge to the Office of the Fair Trading's handling of a competition law investigation relating to manufacturers and retailers of tobacco. The OFT found breaches of the Competition Act. Various manufacturers and retailers entered into what's known as early resolution agreements, ERAs. Such parties admitted liability and agreed to cooperate in exchange for a lower fine. One such party, TMR, who entered into an ERA, managed to extract from the OFT an undertaking that if they did not appeal, but other parties did, and that appeal was successful, they would benefit from the outcome of the appeal. No other parties who entered into ERAs was given such an undertaking. Some manufacturers and retailers who hadn't entered into an ERA appealed, and you guessed it, they were successful. So TMR, relying on this promise, said, we want our costs, we want the £2.5 million we paid in the fine back and our costs, and the OFT gave it to them. Now, the other parties who had entered into an ERA but hadn't got this undertaking said, hang on, if they're getting their fine back, we want our fine back. The OFT refused. That was challenged. At first instance, the challenge failed. In the Court of Appeal, the challenge was successful. The Court of Appeal noted that it was common ground that the OFT must comply with the principle of equal treatment in all steps leading up to the imposition of a penalty. And the Court of Appeal concluded that they had not complied with this principle of equal treatment. The Supreme Court, however, unanimously overturned the Court of Appeal decision. Notwithstanding the agreement of all parties before the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court concluded that equal treatment was not a separate ground of judicial review. Similarly, substantive unfairness was not a distinct ground for judicial review. What the court should be doing is looking at whether the parties had a legitimate expectation or whether the decision was irrational. No representations had been made to the other parties who entered into an ERA that they would get a refund if someone else had a successful appeal. So there's no legitimate expectation claim. And the court concluded that it was not irrational to treat the cases differently. There was some suggestion that the undertaking given to TMR was a mistake, and therefore it was perfectly rational to treat the other parties differently. But I think this is quite a harsh judgment. It may have been driven to an extent by the sums involved and the adverse impact on the taxpayer if the claim was successful. But I think it's a little surprising, given the common ground that was accepted by the parties as to the approach to equal treatment. Finally, and I think I'm going to be on time, some procedural matters. First case I want to deal with is Citizens UK. This case concerns the duty of candour. This is a matter that has been increasingly raised in judicial review litigation. The courts have held that it applies equally to the defendant and the claimant. This case concerned the defendant's duty of candour, the Secretary of State's duty of candour. The substantive decision was the decision in question, which concerned the expedited process applied to unaccompanied asylum-seeking children held in what's known as the jungle, was unfair and thus unlawful. However, half of the judgment, 85 paragraphs worth, concerned the duty of candour and why the Secretary of State had failed to comply with it. And the court took into account their failure to comply when analysing the correct approach to costs in this case. And I set out a few key points. It's a judgment of Lord Justice Singh. He concluded that duty of candour required a lot from public authorities. Although some of the earlier case law in this context talks about the duty of full and frank disclosure, the duty of candour is not about disclosure of documents per se. You can't discharge it just by giving the claimant huge numbers of documents and not pointing out the critical ones to them. You have to do more than just provide them with the relevant documentation. It was said that the defendants have to provide the good, the bad, and the ugly. And importantly, it said witness statements filed must not engage in spin. I think there's going to be some debate about when witness statements do and do not engage in spin. I'm not sure I've read a decent witness statement that does not engage in spin. In fact, sometimes there's not much other than spin in witness statements. But if you're acting for a claimant, this is something that I think one may want to focus on. Court said the duty of candour is a duty to disclose all material facts known to a party in judicial review proceedings, duty not to mislead the court, which can occur by omission, for example, by the non-disclosure of a material document or fact, or by failing to identify the significance of a document or fact. So it's not just not including a document, it's by failing to flag up that it's significant. So a quite onerous duty. Finally, very briefly, costs. The Court of Appeal in Emmon Croydon gave quite detailed guidance on the approach to costs where claims settled. The hope was that would lead to claims, the cost being agreed and not, the courts not being bothered with lots of arguments as to costs after claims have settled. That expectation has been dashed. There are, I think, literally hundreds of cases every year where parties argue over costs when the matter has settled. In the Khan case, Lord Justice Singh again reiterated the guidance in Emmon Croydon, detailed three categories of case, and emphasised that disputes over costs should not lead to satellite litigation over the merits of the underlying claim. As you're aware, there's quite strict guidance on how much you can say on cost disputes. You're limited to two pages of A4. I think one interesting point in Khan, the claimant in Khan said, we were successful, therefore we should get all our costs. And they were successful in one way because they got the result they were seeking. But they didn't get the result they were seeking because of the arguments articulated in judicial review. They got their what they wanted as a result of other litigation brought by other parties. And in those circumstances, the courts did not treat them as wholly successful, and they only got some of their costs after a particular date. I think that means I'm 20 seconds early, so I'm not going to get told off by Karen. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening. For more details, please visit 11kbw.com.